Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the EDH Retcast, where we're all about Commander, data, and dad jokes. I'm Joey Schultz and I'm joined by my fantastic co-hosts. I don't have a silly intro joke for him. I just want to say congratulations, Matt. We hit 300 episodes. It's Matt Morgan.
So my partner recently found out that I was cheating after she found all the letters I was hiding. She's pretty mad, but she'll get over it, though. She's just never going to play Scrabble with me again.
Okay. Wow, dude. I was like, bold move announcing some stuff in front of the internet about cheating. I was like, whoa.
Different kind of cheating. My bad. I should spell it out better next time.
Spell it out better. Wow. All right. And up next, I'm also going to say just a straight up congratulations on episode 300, dude. It's Dana Roach. Hi, Dana.
It is so cold here right now. I actually had to open the fridge to get some warm air.
Oh, no. I'm so sorry.
Standing in front of it, rubbing my hands together as the warm air poured out.
You get an ice pack and put in your slippers just to keep your toes warm.
Yeah.
It also is cold here. I get it.
Yeah, it's been pretty wild. Holy. All right. Well, guys, it's episode 300. Matt, what are we talking about on this 300th episode, dude?
Well, this week, we're going to take a moment. We're going to do a little Ask Me Anything type of episode. We haven't done a mailbag in quite a while, so we figured this is a good opportunity to field some questions from our listeners, from some friends of ours, and just kind of talk about the format and just where we are.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be really entertaining, but we've got a couple of shout outs to do before we jump into it. First and foremost, we got to thank Chase, aka Mana Curves, for their terrific work on the post-production of the show. Thank you so, so much, Chase. We love having you as part of the team.
We're also excited to announce that we'll be part of Team Ultimate Guard in 2024. It was a pretty easy decision to make. I have all of my stuff in Ultimate Guard deck boxes anyway, so it's a product that we are big fans of, and we're looking forward to working with them in 2024.
I mean, I'm a huge fan of Ultimate Guard stuff. Their deck boxes, their boulders, if you love it, their Katana sleeves, probably the best sleeves around. I don't know about you, Joey, but...
Those boulders are so good. Those Katanas are so slick. Yes. Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. And, like, they're smart hives. If you're trying to organize everything, just their storage is just top-notch. I just can't say enough about Ultimate Guard. And, yeah, we're excited to be part of it.
Heck yeah.
And also, if you would like to support the show, you can do so by leaving a comment, liking this video on YouTube, subscribing on YouTube, subscribe and leave a review on your local podcast app, or you can go to patreon.com/EDHRetcast, where we have patron tiers of all sorts of levels. Whether you want to join our Discord community for as little as $2 a month, there's all that and more over at patreon.com/EDHRetcast, including our weekly patron shoutout. So this week, Tucker Kraft, thank you so much. I see you crafted a very solid plan to go to patreon.com/EDHRetcast to support us. I would say I'm trying to think of something good for Tucker, but I'm just out of ideas.
I would say the Tucker rule is back. We've reinstated the Tucker rule in Commander. That's my silly joke.
There it is. I'm stuckered on Tucker, so.
Oh my goodness.
Shame on me.
Thank you so much, Tucker. Thank you to all of our patrons, all of the viewers and listeners out there for supporting us through 300 freaking episodes. That is wild. We're really excited to hit this milestone, and we're going to do a little Q&A, a little AMA, just kick back and answer some questions from our friends and folks out there in the community. We solicited some questions from our patrons in our Patreon Discord. This will be entertaining. Dana, I guess, where are we starting? What's the first question that we're going to answer here on this 300th episode AMA?
First question we got here was from Tomar from MTG Goldfish. What's a pet card you run despite it being unoptimal? And I'll guess, Joey, what's your answer here? What card do you run that isn't optimal, but you can't not run it?
I fully put Liquid Metal Torque into every deck that I play these days. Like, and it's just good. Just turning stuff into artifacts is just fun. Even if I'm not in colors that can, like, destroy artifacts to get the extra benefit off of that, I still will put it into, like, my mono black decks or my Dimir decks just in case someone else plays, like, a Reclamation Sage so that I can destroy something with that.
Yeah.
So that's probably my pick. I think that might be my answer, but it's just a good card. So, oh man, I just love it so much.
I mean, judging by our Mana Rock rankings that we did a few weeks ago, that makes sense that you would put it into literally every deck that you could put it in.
Yeah.
I think for me though, like, I know Rishkar's Expertise is a great card, but I still put it in decks. Like you said, Joey, it's not great here. Like, it's a good card, but like, it's not really taking advantage. Like, okay, cool. I drew two cards and I got to do my extra thing maybe. But I still put it in every deck. It's just one of my favorite cards of all time. Like, I remember just laughing to myself the first time I cast it. I just want to feel that feeling all over again.
For me, I guess the first answer would be, I see a lot of people did like, who even runs Phyrexian Arena anymore? I do. I like Phyrexian Arena. And I understand the arguments against it. It takes multiple turns for it to generate value commensurate to what it costs to cast. I still like it. It just was one of those cards that like feels good to have in play. I just never feel bad about it. And I absolutely could find better cards running that slot in every deck where I'm running it. And I don't care. It just feels good. Like I'm still playing EDH back in 2013. I love that card. And the same is true of Reliquary Tower. I have Reliquary Tower in a ton of decks. I totally understand the arguments against running it in the utility land slot. They all make sense to me, and I don't care. I want to hold on to all of my cards. I want to have a full grip. I'm still running Reliquary Tower despite all the reasons that I completely understand to no longer be running it.
I mean, you do get to pay life to draw cards, which is what you like to do, Dana. So
absolutely love doing that.
I don't think anybody's surprised by our picks here.
No, honestly, no. Just like the only thing that's maybe surprising is that Dana's pick of Reliquary Tower is a card that I actively avoid because I want to discard a hand size so that I can reanimate things more easily. Like, moving to our next question here, we actually got the same question from two different folks. So one of our Discord patrons, Tube of Glue, and also our friend Lenny Woolley, who's a writer for Idiotrek, both asked us, what's your favorite deck that you don't own? And I know my answer for this, and I'm actually, if you guys don't mind, I'm going to jump right into it, because my favorite deck that I don't own that I've ever seen someone else play is actually Rachel Weeks's Clue deck that she built like years and years ago, where she's actually using the cards from the Clue game, like Colonel Mustard and the Wrench and all of those. And like before the game begins, she will set up one of those mysteries in the like little folder. And then like as she makes clues in the game, she will flip over like, oh, it's Miss Scarlet. Oh, here's the Miss Picard card. Here's the ballroom or whatever. So she's like playing an EDH game. I think it's like her Eloise Clue deck or whatever, and making a bunch of Clue tokens. But she's also trying to solve the mystery of whatever's in that little folder. And she's playing two games at once, and it blew my freaking mind. I love that one so much. So that is absolutely a thing I've got to shout out here. I love that deck just to bits.
I mean, Rachel is pretty good at just coming up with these wacky and funny and also just like fun to watch decks. So I'm not surprised to hear that. I think my choice for the deck that I don't own is I don't own it yet type of situation, where the Cats and Dogs Secret Lair deck. Yeah, please. I don't need any cats, but I want the dogs. So I might like hit up some artists at the next event at Magic Con Chicago, maybe, if you folks want to see us there. Maybe get some altars done for some sweet dog art. But that's just me.
That Anointed Procession art is precious.
Gorgeous.
A couple of years ago, and this was actually, I believe, in Chicago 2019 at the Command Fest, they had a smaller event. I ran into a person who pulled out their Atraxa deck and did the, oh no, this Atraxa deck is different. It's a different, you know, it's not that Atraxa deck. And it, in fact, was not that Atraxa deck.
Hey.
It was a horror typal deck, because Atraxa is an angel horror.
Okay.
And
yeah.
We've gotten some decent horrors since then. There were not decent horrors in 2019, for whatever reason.
Yeah.
It was a bunch of really terrible horror creature types, almost all of which were old border because they were all old cards. But the deck worked, and I just appreciated that level of deep dive. It was just a really, like, somebody who had an idea and ran with the idea and didn't care about the fact that I was forced to run 16 of the 17 terrible horrors from, you know, back in Stronghold. So that was the one, that was an experience that I walked away from really appreciating what that person did and their commitment to like thinking outside the box.
That's terrific. Yeah.
Well, and Dana, that's always such a fun feeling, is seeing something that is super unique to people. And just for me, it makes it such a great experience to play against, which actually that leads into our next question that comes from one of our listeners, Sam. They asked, what are your co-hosts' favorite decks to play against and why? So what are your favorite decks to play against? Because I know my answer. I'll give mine right away. It's my favorite deck to play against is the one that is the most unique to that person that I'm playing with. Mm. It's always fun. Like, I know how I brew decks. And so I like getting to see how other people get to brew their own decks and see what comes from other people's minds. It's the same reason I don't like to read books, but I'll watch the movie.
I'll admit, I actually interpreted this question a little bit differently. I thought that Sam might have been asking about, like, for me, for instance, what is my favorite deck of Dana's and my favorite deck of Matt's to play against?
Sure.
I might have been misinterpreting their question. I'm not sure. But the answer that I prepared was that Matt's Raga Draga deck is never not an absolute blast to play against, mm-hmm. because of just the oh no moments that can happen from that, and how cool it is to see Raga Draga pumping up all of those things that you bequeath mana abilities upon. And then for Dana, I love the fact that both Vela and Asperia can, like, they're obvious with what they're going to do to you, and yet they still manage to sneak up on you. And I don't know how you do that, but it's very, very cool.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. My interpretation of this, too, was a little bit different. What's your deck to play against, like, strategy-wise, strategically, that kind of thing.
Oh.
And I always think of my friend Max Crandall, who I used to do a show Commander Central with, has a Brago deck. And it's very kind of what you would expect from a Brago deck, right? It's blinking things for a tremendous amount of value. But there's something about the deck that feels fair. Brago's kind of a busted commander, and it's doing a bunch of busted things. But I can see the inflection points. Brago has to deal combat damage to trigger the thing. So you kind of, for the most part, know, okay, I need to keep Brago from doing this. So if I have a blocker, or I can move this around or keep this from happening, I can see what I have to do. So as long as I can execute, I can compete against it. And if I mess up, everything falls apart. And I like that feeling of playing against a deck where I'm walking on that edge, where I feel like if I do everything at the absolute best that I can do it and execute to the best of my abilities, I can win this game, but it's in my hands to not drop the ball. I like that feeling in a deck. That particular deck makes me feel that way, but any deck where I feel like it's in my hands to keep the thing from winning and put myself in a position to win the game. I like that vibe.
Nice. I love that we all had completely different interpretations of this very straightforward question.
Right, yeah.
What's wrong with us?
Well, there was kind of a sub-question here, too, from the fellows at One More Mana. They asked, if you had to adopt one of your co-host decks, and that's the only deck you could play for a year, which one would it be and why?
Ooh. That's a really good question. I think between both of your decks, I really like the decks that, like, they get their setup, and then they just explode, and it's just kind of hard to, like, deal with the explosion of value, and you get overrun with it. So I think, Dana, your Itch Tekkic deck is absolutely a blast to play against and just watch it explode and enjoy. In the same way, your +1/+1 counters deck, your partner commanders, they just sit around in Ishai all of a sudden, like, before you know it, has 14, 15 counters, and then you double it somehow, and then you double it again somehow, and then we're dead.
Yeah, absolutely. Love moving those around. Oh, this is such an interesting question. Dana, do you have to pick one of my decks. What are you playing?
Your baby was on your deck. And
yeah.
There's a mini game going on.
Yeah.
So everything you sacrifice takes resources away from you, but you're drawing cards. So you're trying to find this balance where, like, you get the most efficient use of things you sacrifice to draw the most cards that are hurting your board state. So you're kind of playing two games at once. You're playing the larger game you're trying to win, and you're playing a mini game with your own board to try to generate the most value. And you can screw that mini game up.
Yeah.
Like, there's not a clear choice every time. You have to make intelligent decisions. I like the fact that, like, it's forcing you to be a good player.
Nice. Yeah. All right. I think that there was a compliment hidden in there, and I will take that. Thank you. For each of y'all's, for Dana, I'll quickly say Dana's got that Tivash Gloom Summoner deck, which is playing around with, like, how much life you've lost. And I'm still looking for a place to put all the parts of my old Greven deck back together, because I enjoy playing with life loss as a strategy. But I want more colors than just Tavash. But like, I do miss that strategy enough that I'd be like, if I were to pick from Dana, that would be it. But I think my first instinct when I saw that question was Matsve Victus as Mahdi the Dire deck, which is the Jund thing that lets you cheat stuff into play.
The Jund thing is a good way to put it. Yeah.
Like, you're cheating stuff into play. You're killing stuff. There's a little bit of randomness. There's a little bit of control going on there. You get to sneak attack things. Like, it looks very straightforward, but then it will also just oopsie hasty the entire board out of nowhere. And I like cheating stuff into play, and you get to sacrifice stuff for value. Like, that's got me written all over it. I think that's like a vibe that, like, I couldn't live without sacrificing things for more than a year. So I've got to say Vivictus.
You're sacrificing, you're reanimating. There's a lot of Joey notes in that deck, and I'm glad that you enjoy that.
Also, can we really quick, the One More Mana guys, said Ken and Derek, also left us a bonus question that is thoroughly not Magic related that says, also, if aliens invaded Earth and declared that you had to perform an interpretive dance for the fate of humanity, what song are you picking? And we have to answer this,
Bleeding
you guys.
Love by Leona Lewis.
That was fast.
I only know the answer so quickly because I have done that. Not for the sake of, like, for the fate of the planet, but if you were at the Galaxy Bowl in Edina, Minnesota back in 2010 or so, you would have seen me doing an interpretive dance to that very song.
That's amazing. Matt, though, I think that the obvious answer is clearly Fergalicious.
Fergalicious Def.
Dana, do you have a pick?
For me, it would have been Varro by Sigur Rós in reference to the It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia episode, Mac finds his pride that closes out
there
with
we
the,
go.
Ooh. With a 5 to 7 minute interpretive dance in front of a prison.
Oh, wow. Okay. Dana going for the heartfelt one.
Dana
over
went
here.
Right, yeah, yeah, yeah. Dana went a very different direction than we did.
Yeah, honestly. By the way, thank you to Sid, Ken, and Derek for such an amazing question. We love you guys.
Yes. Yes. Well, so the next question, let's keep plugging along here. Chase, one of our editors, are very lovely people. Asked us the question, what is a legendary creature that made you fall in love with the format? And I think we've talked about this before, but it would be nice to hear this all over again. What about you guys?
For me, Glyph of the Traitor. It's a great creature. It's great art. It has a great ability. It's a great chunk of lore and story. Glyssa being like the hero of one block and the tragedy of her as a character being turned into Phyrexian. And no one knows it was against her will and happened, you know, not intentionally. And everyone thinks, hence the traitor portion. Mm-hmm. My favorite little bit of Magic storyline, I think, ever, in addition to being a fantastic card and a great deck. And it was just everything at once in one little rectangle of cardboard.
Nice. That's a really cool answer. Also, Golgari, hey, what's up?
There we go.
For me, Mimeoplasm was the first commander deck that I ever played, and I think it ignited the spark. It is still, I think, my favorite legendary creature design ever, like combining two creatures, smushing them together to see what ridiculous T-Rex combination you can make is terrific and leads to so many different things that you can do. And I think that like gave the spark, but the one that really cemented it or that like fanned those flames was Titania, Protector of Argoth. Just like finding a new thing that I can sacrifice that isn't just creatures. It kind of like turned me into the madman that I am today. So probably those two are like high up on my list of things that made me like, oh, I'm a commander player for sure now. How about you, Matt?
So it turns out I have a type, and Mael the Anima was my first commander, but also I kind of realized like, oh, okay, maybe this commander format is okay after all, because I was a big naysayer at first. I was like, this sounds dumb. Doesn't sound interesting. And then I played a Mael deck and I haven't left. I'm still here.
Yeah.
However many years later, 10 plus years, just cheating big things into play. And so, yeah, Mael the Anima just absolutely hit the right chord of just, oh, this is what I want to do from here on out.
That's so true. You can really trace the through line from your Mael deck to your Vivictus deck, cheating enormous creatures right
into play. You very much can, yeah.
Some of the very same creatures, in fact.
Right, yeah.
And this actually does connect to another question that we got from two different folks. So one of our patrons, New Lou, submitted this question. And Jen from the streaming couple Filthy Casuals also asked, how does your first EDH deck or commander compare to your most recent one? So Matt, you were just talking about Mael. Was that your first commander deck? And how does it compare to the most recent thing that you've built.
So that was my very first commander deck. And yeah, it was just big plotting and it just makes things go boom. My most recent commander deck actually is Arden and Kedis, which is, it's all about slapping a bunch of equipments onto just one creature and just turning things sideways. So I'm dealing a lot of combat damage in one turn still, but the way that I'm doing it is very, very different. And I just happen, well, I guess too, back then, my L deck, it was mostly back in the age of when, you know, I only want to build decks out of packs that I open. Mm. And this Arden and Kedis deck is that, actually. It was just, it's literally just stuff that I had laying around or cards that I opened in packs because a friend of mine gave me some Commander Legends packs. So that's how that entire deck has come to be. And so it's there's a little bit of overlap there, but the speed is very much different, though. I think that's going to be the biggest difference.
I still brew the same way I did when I first put my first deck together, very like slowly and purposefully, and doing, you know, deep searches for like a really specific combination of words on a card that will do this thing I wanted to do for this one particular deck. I was doing that from the first deck I brewed, and I'm still doing it now. I would say the main thing that's different is I'm aware of things like, how's this game going to end? Am I going to win? Versus back then when I'm like, I just had this idea and I'm going to build this idea. And there was no thought to like, how would I close the game out with this idea? Other than hope someone was at 3 life when I had a 3/3 in play and they didn't have any blockers. That was my plan.
Mm.
Whereas today I'm much more conscious of like, at some point I need to figure out, okay, I have this idea. Does this idea have the ability to like push me to an end point in the game? How can I get from point A to point B? And I didn't do that at all back in the day.
No, that's a really good point. That's something that I've noticed too, is that like I have a section in my deck lists dedicated to the oomph. Like that's my oomph cards or my win condition cards, where I certainly did not used to build that way. I just sort of took it for granted that eventually games would end. So that's a really astute observation. For me, my first deck in Commander was obviously the Mimeoplasm. I got that pre-con, which is all about, you know, cheating things into play, brutal efficiency, tons of death. And I was fully one of those like Grave Pact all day kind of players when I first started off. I've certainly changed a lot from that. I still love cheating things into play. But like now the most recent deck that I've built is fully like a Jeskai Rule Zero deck. And that's, I'm like, I don't recognize this person anymore. And this is the Rule Zero deck where every time that I cast the commander again from the command zone, it's actually like evolved into the next version of that character in their story. So like I'm prioritizing very, very silly stuff compared to my very deadly beginnings in the format. So I'm happy to see, I call that character growth, I think.
we'll let it count as character growth, yes.
Thank you. Well, that's been a lot of really awesome questions so far, and we have plenty more, but we have a quick thing we got to pause to do before we move on, and that is challenging the stats, because there's a whole bunch of data on EDH Rec, but we don't always agree with it. So here in our 300th episode, we are going to challenge those stats after a very quick break.
So I'll get us started off this week, and I've been going through and just trying to find some different ways that people approach the game. And Jesse Plotkin, who writes articles over at EDH Rec, who writes the Singleton Schmingleton article series, just talking about being able to find multiple copies of different types of effects, had a really good synergy that I just wanted to kind of drive in and just kind of expand on. So Lazelle's Acrobatics is a card I just totally missed over. Just leave it to Baldur's Gate being the set that 2 years later is still giving us so many gems.
Yeah.
So Lazelle's Acrobatics is 3 and a white for an instant. Says exile all non-token creatures you control, then roll a d20, and on a 1 to 9 roll, you return those cards to the battlefield under their owner's control at the beginning of the next end step. Or if you hit a 10 to 20, you return those cards to the battlefield under their owner's control, then exile them again and return them to the battlefield under their owner's control at the beginning of the next end step. So if you're playing anything that likes to flicker any given spell, maybe like a Panharmonicon deck, I just think this is absolutely a card you want to be giving another look at. I mean, yes, there's a lot of decks out there. Panharmonicon is in almost 150,000 decks. And there's all sorts of different versions of Panharmonicon now with the new Elesh Norn that doubles your triggers. And there's a few, but not a ton, of ways to kind of get more triggers out of this. So Lazelle's Acrobatics is only played in 24% of decks also running Panharmonicon. If you want to double and then double the double, which is a math lesson I'm not ready to give to all of you here, this is absolutely a fantastic card that's going to save your board. It's going to return them at the beginning of the next end step, which means you can dodge board wipes. and also get all those triggers. And if you roll well, you're going to get so many more triggers there. It's just an incredible value card. Absolutely worth running. And I, like I said, Baldur's Gate, I forgot this card existed. And this is a great reminder that Baldur's Gate is going to still give us cards probably for the next 5 years, I would wager. But yeah, if you're playing Panharmonic under just any deck that loves Enter the Battlefield abilities, Lazelle's Acrobatics is a fantastic card.
And you say if you roll well, but like, isn't it even slightly more than half the time that's what you're going to get, just like with the math on it? Like,
yeah, you don't even need to roll well. You
know? It's just like, yeah, good odds.
Very good odds. Yeah, and there's other cards similar to this. Semester's End has the same mana cost that brings them in with +1/+1 counters or loyalty counters. There's a whole slew of cards like this, but Lazelle's Acrobatics, if you just really want to go hard with ETB triggers, I don't think there's many cards that are going to be better than that.
Yeah, yeah. The times that you get that double blink benefit, it's just going to be, that is so much value. It'll be very difficult for your opponents to catch up. And if you're doing it like to save from a board wipe, Matt, I love this. I absolutely love this. What a cool card. I'll move to my challenge now. And it's a little bit of a recycled challenge from a bit ago. On a past episode, I believe I once talked about how Kadena Slinking Sorcerer can actually make use of the card Mystic Forge because of some weird stuff. Kadena Slinking Sorcerer is the Soul Time Morph Commander, and Mystic Forge is that strange 4-mana artifact that says you can look at the top card of your library at any time, you may cast artifact spells and colorless spells from the top of your library, and you can also tap it, pay a life, and exile the top card of your library. The reason that this is relevant for Kadena is because you can actually cast morph spells this way, which seems counterintuitive, but according to the rulings on Mystic Forge's Scryfall page, if the top card of your library has a morph ability, you can cast it face down from the top of your library, even if it's not normally a colorless card. So that's awesome, and the reason that I want to recycle it here, I mean, yeah, it's relevant that it's only showing up currently in 26% of the 4,600 decks for Kadena currently, but also in the Murders at Karlov Manor, not Markov Manor. We've just gotten some, I'm going to have to correct myself every single time with that said. We've also just gotten the set mechanic Disguise, where you can once again cast cards face down for 3 mana as a 2/2 colorless creature. And it happens to have Ward 2, because of course it does. Everything needs to have Ward 2 these days. But if this is another way to create colorless things, then Mystic Forge will help you cast those Disguise cards too, I assume. There's no reason to assume that it would work any differently than the current way that Morph works. So yeah, look at Mystic Forge if you're going to end up playing any of those Disguise or Morph synergies, because this is a really cool way to get those creatures off the top of your deck and right into play where you want them. So give Mystic Forge a look.
Tube of Glue gave us a question we read a few minutes ago, but they are also the suggester of this week's listener challenge of stats. And Tubaglu writes, time for everyone's favorite pastime, non-bow challenges.
Ooh.
And this time I'm going to keep it short. Shrine is not a creature type. It's an enchantment type. And therefore, 78% of eligible Goshen Tai of Life Origins decks should be reconsidering the Roaming Throne they include in their deck, because it can't choose Shrine or can't choose your commanders as a creature type at all. There's maybe some decks out there that have enough other things you could choose that could justify it, but I would wager of that 78% running it, 90% of those are running it because they think they can say Shrine, and you in fact can't in that deck. So great Nombo, great Flying Tube of Glue. Good question earlier. Thank you very much for supporting the show and being a great listener.
Yeah, short, sweet, to the point. We love non-bow challenges here, and that's a very tricky one. Shrine being an enchantment subtype rather than a creature type. Yeah, it's hard to catch, but that is definitely relevant. So keep your eye out for any of those cards that you'd want to put into your Shrine deck to put your creatures, because there are enchantment creatures, but the Shrine is part of the enchantment part, not part of the creature part, which is weird. This game is weird. This game has weird rules, you guys.
That one's very unintuitive. I would have made that mistake myself.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, we will get back into our main topic here. I believe our next question comes to us from user Lightfoot, one of our patrons here. And this is actually a really fitting question to have right after Challenge the Stats, because they're asking, is there a particular Challenge the Stats or Challenge the Stats segue that you're especially proud of? Matt, I know that you and I are on the same wavelength with regards to this question.
I don't have one. Yeah, I have some that I'm proud of, but my favorite all-time segue, I think, is actually Dana's, where he started talking about the person who invented the Segway scooter, and I had no idea what he was talking about until it finally clicked, and I remember laughing so hard. It was just absolutely out of left field. It was one of the true, like, probably the reason it was such a joy to do last year as far as stealing the segues. But yeah, that's still my favorite.
Big same. Absolutely big same. That was so, he was just like, do you know who Dean Kamen is? And I'm just like, Dana, we're doing an EDH podcast episode. What are you talking about? And then it just like clunked into place. And it was like, no, my life is flashing before my eyes.
Well, thank you both very much for that. I appreciate that.
In terms of like the actual like specifics of a challenge, the stats thing, not just the segues, I do like sort of like we just saw with Tube of Glue, I like those non-bow sort of identifiers. So one that I definitely come back to a lot are those kind of unintuitive things. For instance, one that I really enjoyed was in coin flip decks, like a Zender Split and Okaun deck, there are cards like the card Mana Clash, which are worded slightly differently. They don't care about winning coin flips. They care about whether the result of the coin flip is heads or tails, and that does not count as winning a coin flip. And those are, again, small, weird things that can trip you up a whole lot, but there are those types of cards that at first seem like they are a cert for that deck, but actually super aren't. So that's one that I really enjoy pointing out, is that, like, hey, this will definitely, you know, this unfortunately doesn't work in your deck, even though it totally feels like it should. It's worded very slightly differently, and that can help people avoid any oops or gotcha moments in a game, any feel bads moments like that. So those are some of my favorite challenges for sure. Those are the ones that I like most when we do them.
Yeah, stuff like the one from Tube of Glue today about the non-bow, that there was, I think the first one I remember that jumped out at me was, I think Matt did Propaganda in Super Friends decks really early on.
Yeah.
Propaganda doesn't prevent you from attacking planeswalkers. And that was, again, one of those ones where not only is it a good challenge, it was useful because I don't know if I'd ever made that connection prior to that. So it was a good challenge because it taught me something too. And I like those ones where, like, it's a, you catch a real interesting interaction that even is useful for us.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah. The non-bows are just always the ones we mention them when we do that because we like them so much. And just, it's easy to find a pet card that, you know, oh, I think this card could see more play. The whole format is full of cards that could see more play, but it's always fun to see, especially when something that just actively does not work or does something you don't want it to do. That's when we really just enjoy hearing that because it just requires that next step of thinking. We hope that we're sparking that on our listeners as well.
Okay, so now moving into another question. This one comes to us from our friend Olivia Gobert-Hicks, who's on the Rules Committee, who's asking us some little punchier here, guys. How does data get skewed by precons, and how can people avoid that issue? I feel like I can already hear Matt's brain firing with an answer he's eager to get to, so Matt will let you answer first.
Well, so I do like this question, and it's something that we sometimes feel like, well, you're pretending that the data is perfect.
No.
Never once in the history of EDH Rec have we ever said this is perfect information, perfect data. Joe, you like to say this is not prescriptive. Mm-hmm. That's a great way to put it. And so I personally, and you guys I know like these tools too, but for me personally, there's two different tools that we like to use on the website. One is Advanced Filters, the best part of the website far and away. Mm. But also there's a precon upgrade tool in there as well. So if you can plug in any of the given precon commanders, it's going to show you what people are cutting, what people are adding into those decks. And it makes it a lot easier to navigate. So when you combine those two, I like to take the cards that people are cutting the most and then going to that commander's page using the advanced filter to exclude the cards you want to cut.
Yep.
A lot of people kind of think that advanced filters, you want to look at cards that or decks that are playing any given card. Well, you can also do it the other way around. You can only look at decks that are not playing any given card. I think that is a fantastic way to cut out a lot of the noise that might be interfering with pre-constructed deck commanders. Same way we talk with CEDH. If you want to look at a commander that maybe has a CEDH reputation, use advanced filters and exclude out the decks that are playing Mox Diamond. It's an absolutely fantastic tool to help get more specific data to what you want to be looking for.
Yeah, couldn't have said it better myself.
To go back to the precon thing really briefly, we actually had a name for that, the precon effect, particularly years ago, because the data would get so skewed by a precon, people would just enter their entire list and it would look like, you know, the 100 cards from the precon were the optimal or the ones people were playing the most because they were just the defaults that they were entering. But that was back in a time when we'd get 4 or 5 commander decks a year, and that was it. So like people would just enter their decks. I think today we live in a world where when we get 50 commander decks a year. I think number one, you just see way less of that because people, everyone isn't buying the same four decks. There's too many decks for people to buy. And I think therefore they're not entering this. Everyone's not putting the same copy, the same version of that Jaleva deck out there because that everyone bought it once upon a time because there was only a couple of commander decks coming out. I think the data is less skewed from pre-cons today than it was 7 years ago.
I think the biggest success that I've had with pre-constructed deck commanders is either use advanced filters and include a shock land, just one, in that commander's colors.
Yeah.
Because that's a good way to signify if a person who uploaded the deck has gone through and they really just created the mana base from scratch, or exclude one of the random lands that they put in there. One of those common lands that entered the battlefield tapped. Maybe it's like an Urborg volcano or something like that. Yeah. Exclude that out of the deck list that you're going to look at. That instantly gets you 100% better results when you're looking at the advanced filters. That might be the most helpful tool when it comes to getting rid of all of the noise with the pre-cons that people just load up on the websites. That right there might be the best that I've had luck with.
No notes, complete cosign on all of that. Yeah, it's such a terrific, terrific tool. And, you know, sometimes people do get a little confused. They think that EDHREC will scrape data from, like, any deck building websites, like, will scrape exact precon duplicates. We don't, but there are still those, you know, times where a thing can look close enough to the precon. A couple of cards were changed, 10 cards were changed, that there is still that influence there. But yeah, Matt, you're absolutely right. Advanced filters will help you find the stuff that is better tailored to the things that you want to play. And it's such a lovely, lovely tool. And that question from Olivia actually also kind of gets us into another question from Rachel Weeks of Command Zone fame, asking us yet another kind of punchy one here, you guys. How has EDHREC changed the landscape of Commander? Kind of a big one there. Is there...
That is a huge question.
Yeah. Do you want to take the first bite, first crack at it?
I'll let Dana take the first one so that I can gather all my thoughts together.
Okay.
So at a high level, let me throw a little bit of background information or explanation out there and say math changes everything. Mm. Whether it's like the game of baseball in the last 10, 15 years has changed significantly because of things like launch angle, where like they've broken down the math behind the way you swing. And statistically speaking, swinging at this angle, maybe making the ball leave the bat at this angle results in more home runs, results in more safe hits, whatever. The NBA and the discovery of like the statistics behind three-pointers versus shooting a, you know, long two-pointer, whatever.
Right.
Whenever you throw math into the equation, it changes or gives you better understanding of how things work. And that applies to everything from gaming to sports to sales to politics to whatever. It shouldn't be a surprise that someone did the same thing here with Magic and Commander, and Commander's a perfect way to do that. So it was going to happen. It happens in everything. So when people say, you know, EDHREC has done this or that to Commander, it was going to happen. The math is, you're not going to keep the math from getting out, the statistics from getting out. So yeah, it happened, and it changed Commander in the same way that the launch angle changed baseball. People figured out how to better optimize their decks. Some folks that led to the birth of CDH in some aspects, and it led to some people like being more conscious and toning their decks down and not following that to the natural endpoint. But yeah, very much decks are definitely much more efficient and faster than they were 10 years ago, in large part because of things like EDHREC.
Well, and Dana, you put it really well, and I have to agree. If EDHREC didn't come around, there's a lot of smart people that play this game. And one of those smart people would have put the pieces together to do effectively what EDHREC is doing. And so it just happens to be in this current form, and we just happen to be getting to represent it effectively. As far as what EDHREC, though, has done to the landscape of Commander, I think the exchange of information has just accelerated so stinking fast. Like, people are able to solve things so much quicker. And that doesn't apply just to Commander. I think that applies to every Magic format. People are able to... I mean, we had cards that were printed in the Lost Caverns of Ixalan. They were banned, 2 weeks after they were printed? Because people solved those formats so quickly. And EDHREC is the tool that helps transmit all that information from player to player. But I think that's the biggest thing is EDH Rec just made all of the information so much easier to parse instead of just looking at individual deck lists. So you're able to see a format's worth of information. Now, we had to sort it out for players to get it digestible a little bit. But as far as just the speed of information, that's just really that's the culture we're living in as well. Everybody's living in this instant gratification type of mode. And I think EDH Rec is just kind of the representation of that instant gratification culture in the Magic the Gathering commander specific space.
When World of Warcraft was released 19 years ago, it took, I think it was 150 some days for the first raid to be completely cleared. When WoW Classic was released a few years ago, which was functionally that original game, it happened in measurable by hours.
Yeah.
So like within, you know, 3 or 4 days, that first raid was cleared because the information was available to people. People were aware of the math. They were aware of how the fights work. That data was something that like someone at some point in time was going to take and break down. And that happens in everything.
Yeah. Ease of information is always just going to be such a positive for me. I fundamentally don't miss the days of riffling through 800 boxes of game stores to try and find something that I might maybe play in a deck.
Yeah.
I don't miss the days of posting a deck list online and then a whole bunch of people online telling me that I'm an idiot for missing these really key, obvious key cards or stuff like that. And I'm actually just going to pull a quote from Josh Lee Kwai here, I think summed it up really, really well. We're in the information age. If you're going to complain about information being available to people, hey, good luck to you, but I'm sorry you belong in a different century.
Yeah.
And I just think that's really well said. Really well said, man.
Well, and even then, like, yes, EDH Rec is kind of the, we can live with the fact that like, we take the brunt of that, of the, well, we're speeding up information, but Scryfall is an absolutely fantastic tool too. And
oh yeah.
I mean, Wizards of the Coast runs off of Scryfall these days.
Yeah.
Like the fact that Gatherer doesn't really work all that well. Scryfall is such an incredible tool too. So like, I think the people behind Scryfall would have come up with something similar. I mean, there's a reason we get to work with the folks over at Architect because they have great minds about the game too. So that at Moxfield too, like there's so many great minds about this game.
Mm-hmm.
Surely something was going to come along sooner or later.
Yeah. And it's also like, you know, tools are definitely in how you use them because like advanced filters and those theme filters will help you dissect things to find something that is more useful to you. Dana is famous for using EDH Rec specifically to avoid what other people are doing. And that's another terrific way to use that. Or EDH Rec is like unparalleled in its ability to help you browse through individual deck lists because it's got a whole bunch of them mm-hmm. logged there. And also when new cards come out, one of the ways that we tend to measure the success of those products is by their impact of their newest cards. And EDH Rec can help serve as one of those weather vanes. And I find that really helpful that it can sometimes signal in on things like,
yeah.
you know, card impact or format health. And it's really fun. It's really neat. I know that a lot of people out there, if they are in a critical mood, they'll be like, oh, EDH Rec homogenizes things. But I'm just going to submit that, you know, if Tom Bombadil is printed, people are still going to build it as a Saga Commander, regardless of whether EDH Rec exists or not.
Yeah.
Call is
yeah.
coming from inside the Bombadil. Like, that's kind of where
I did not need to use EDH Rec to find more cards for my Tom Bombadil list. That was purely from Scryfall.com search Saga. That was all it took.
And also, it's called EDH recommendations, not EDH. We're forcing you to play these cards. Like, that's the other thing for me. Like,
well, how about let's get into a question about cards that we have to force Dana to play. So April Mary Thief has a question, and it just says, what is your favorite basic land art? Does it vary by the deck they're used in, or do you have a favorite for all decks?
Dana, what a great question for you. Yeah. Who doesn't run basics ever?
Stomping Ground. That's his favorite basic art.
Yeah, that's I do run basics in my decks, just not probably enough. I do tend to, so I run matched basics in my decks, and I tend to try to match something thematic from the deck, although not always. I think my favorite, I like old frame basics from back in the day, old border stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think Odyssey has some tremendous basics, particularly the forests. So my first deck, my Glissa deck, is still running old foil basic Odyssey lands. I just love the way those look, but I try to also match them up thematically if I can. So let my Ichthakic deck that's making golems, I'm running the basic lands from the recent, was it
Marshall and Machines.
March of the Machines that had the lands with the golem or the mm-hmm. robot kind of looking creatures in the art.
Yeah.
Might have been Brothers War, I forget whichever one it was. So I'm using those basics in that deck, the full art versions of those. So I try to match when I can, but yeah, I do put time into choosing my basics for sure.
Yeah, Odyssey probably has overall some of my favorite. Mercadian Masks is another great block for basics. Onslaught also, like the any of the old border and in that era of cards, those were just some of my favorite basics, both for the art. I like the old border. I'm not a monster. I make sure all my basics match, except for one deck. I very specifically in my Valdez.
I was going to say you have one deck where they don't,
but it's very intentional. It's no art can be repeated, including the island that I scribbled mountain on top of.
Can I confess to you guys, I've actually been afraid of answering this question because I've become a little accidentally famous for a joke about a Sam Burley island from March of the Machines.
Oh, the ex-boyfriend, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, we'll just leave it there. Although I'm glad that he found someone, the snow-covered island from... Anyway, I'm going to move on. I do like... Dana, I'm with you. I also like theming my lands. I enjoy using, for example, like the bolus lands with the horns in my Virtus deck because Virtus also has horns, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I do get a little bit bummed out when sometimes, like, to optimize a mana base, you have to... Like, feels the correct to mix and match snow basics to get different names for Field of the Dead, and then I don't get to play as many of the basic land art that I want to, but it is still fun to get that extra benefit from stuff like Field of the Dead. Or when I feel like, oh, I'm using an extra planar lens in this mono colored deck, so like snow lands are less likely to appear across the field from me, so like if I really want to get super optimal here, then playing snow lands is probably what I should do for this. That, like, there are some of those little moments that do occasionally bum me out, but when I can theme the basics, I absolutely want to, because it is just really fun to try and find those things. Yeah.
Yeah. Next question we have here is coming from Alta Biscuit, and it's, what's a lesser known hobby or interest you have that isn't Magic related?
I post fairly often about just Magic fitness. It's one thing that I've been doing most of my life. I like powerlifting. I like working out, just staying active. Social sports leagues, I can't say casual because like we do get worked up every now and then. but it is fun just to like go play like sand volleyball. I do it when the weather's nice and not negative 30 degrees. But indoor soccer is another fun winter sport for me. But also, I do have other nerdy hobbies. Like I play a lot of video games. I like League of Legends. I put, I think, about like 160 hours in Starfield. I very much enjoy Starfield. So I still play video games. I still get nerdy. But I was like, I like being active. I like going out and doing things too, which is, I wish I could hike more, but I'm in Kansas now, so...
Honestly, I love this question because it's nice to remember that there's so much more to the world outside of the silly card game that we play and talk about every week.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I've also gotten pretty big into fitness over the past 2 years, and it's been a wonder, a big life-changing thing for me there. But like, genuinely, if I'm going to take this moment to like rhapsodize about a thing that I really enjoy, I got to shout out the Magnus Archives, which is like my favorite podcast to ever exist in the ever. It's my favorite media, period. It is a horror podcast by Rusty Quill. It is a clean, exact 200 episodes, about 20 minutes per episode. It is a horror drama show, but I've listened through it like 6 times because it's so thrilling, and it tells this long, sprawling, epic tale. Genuinely, it did everything that Game of Thrones should have done. Like, the show's so cool. I would host a full other podcast just talking about how much I love this podcast. Like, that, I'm fully obsessed with the Magnus Archives. Like, so seriously, give it a look. I've gotten so many of my friends to listen to this, and they're all like, yeah, this is really good, because I'm absolutely obsessed. But at the risk of starting an extra podcast, I'm just going to let Dana answer this question now.
I'm a pretty big music nerd. I particularly collect vinyl. So, like, when the weather's nice, especially, a lot of times on a Saturday morning, I'll get on my bike and hit whatever like garage sale, estate sales I see that I think are going to have albums and dig through. And you know, I'm looking for certain specific things.
That's so cool.
So I've got a pretty decent vinyl collection that I actually work towards like finding things. It's not just about buying the thing. It's about like discovering it and finding some hidden gem somewhere.
Yeah.
So that's something that's a big hobby of mine. I read a lot too. I'm a big reader. A lot of like fantasy sci-fi stuff. I'm doing a reread of Stephen Erickson's Malazan Book of the Fallen right now, which is like 10 volumes. And then there's, you know, another probably 10-ish supplementary books. That's probably, I would say, easily the best fantasy series I've ever read. So I usually try to read a couple hundred pages of something per day.
Nice.
Couple hundred pages. That's more than I read.
I'm a pretty fast reader. So yeah, well, I usually can, I can read that in an hour ish.
Like I said earlier, I will watch the movie.
I feel like we just got the Dimir experience and the Selesnya experience, the Naya gruel over there. at least.
Yeah.
couldn't have better summed
it. It's not gruel. I'm not lighting the book on fire.
Yeah, yeah.
Fair.
That's so good. All right, guys. This next one is also a bit of a heavy hitter, but I think it's a really introspective question. It comes to us from our friend Donnie, also of the streaming couple Filthy Casuals. And Donnie asked, how do y'all cope with the downside of content creation? I can only imagine the negativity.
I mean, for me, the big thing is just remembering who we do it for. We're not trying to please the haters. We're trying to please our fans. And so keeping that in perspective and doing things, for me, it's make the content you want to see and make it entertaining for me, informative, give listeners something to take away. And that's just my advice to anyone who wants to get into content creation. Make the content you want to see, that you don't see it out there. What would I like people to do? Well, go out and make it. And you can do it yourself. And yeah, like there's a lot of negativity. But just focus on the folks that you are trying to please and kind of hone your content around that. And that, I think that's what's made us successful here, relatively, I guess. But yeah, just, yes, it is. Sometimes it's hard and sometimes it's discouraging, but also there's a lot of really great moments around it too. And so just remembering like those great moments is kind of what we do it for.
I have probably struggled with this, I think, more than you two, just in that my instinctive reaction is to snap back or lash back at somebody in a way that I think you guys are much better at not doing. I've gotten better at that, I think, but like that's something that I've had to work at being better about doing, because that's not my natural inclination. I think part of that is probably because I've been on the internet longer than you two. And in the internet's early days, if someone said something to you, you were mean back to them. Like that was your reaction. You did that, I think. And I still have that natural response in me that I have to fight against.
I mean, there is, like, I don't like to dwell a lot, like Matt said, but like when I do see something that is antagonistic, I do think that it is fair that there are occasions where you can use examples of that type of attitude or that behavior online and try to craft that into something that is informative or useful for other people so that we can better observe those things that are antagonistic and remind ourselves not to slip into that and like hopefully see where someone got into that cynical attitude and how we ourselves can avoid it or how we can make sure that it's not present in our playgroups, for example, stuff like that. For me specifically for this question, you know, coping with the downside of content creation. I mean, I'm an openly gay dude on a Magic Nerd podcast, right? And there are a lot of people out there who like to spout opinions about that. And that's real cute. But, you know, honestly, can I like full honesty with you guys, like the people who are hurling slurs at us for like featuring or supporting like black people and queer people and women. Honestly, like I know exactly what box to put that into. Like it's really easy to like delete that trash file in my head. The stuff that is harder for me is like, the stuff that I can't sort so easily is when people truly just refuse to engage with the actual thing that you said, and they think that you said something else. And I'm just like, what do I do with you? In my head, I don't know where to put you. Like, that's actually, like, I think that sticks with me a little bit harder sometimes. So, I don't know, kind of a weird example there.
The comments but, yeah. Where you say you like pancakes and they ask what you have against waffles. Yeah, right. Like that.
Exactly that.
That type of comment. Yeah, yeah.
Literally that. Like when I told a joke about Draenith Magistrate and then a couple of people were like, ugh, what do you want this banned? Haven't commander players ever heard of removal spells? And it's just like, that's not what I said. I did not say those words. I said nothing about waffles. Like, yeah, exactly that, Matt. It's harder to know where do I put my emotion with this versus the thing that's just like, oh, I love when the trash takes itself out. Thanks for identifying that we don't need to care about, you know, when someone's being just rude for just being rude. So, yeah. But Donnie, that's a really good question because, yeah, sometimes it is. Huh? But as Matt said, the positives are so much more fun to focus on and also so much more prevalent. Like the negative stuff is it is minuscule by comparison, by far.
Well, and let's wrap it up then with our last question from one last listener from Shaky Mortar and our Patreon Discord. Asked, what was a time you've been surprised by how much impact you've been made on by other Magic players, either through EDH Rec or the podcast? And by the same token, was there ever a moment where you were humbled along those same lines? So kind of a nice question to kind of wrap up and just kind of look back on the 300 episodes that we've had. And just what is there a moment for either of you that kind of stands out above and beyond anything else?
So there's a line in the West Wing where one of the characters, Leo, tells another character, Toby, like, Toby, you're not the outsider nipping at the heels of the party. You are the party. And that at some point resonated with me because like it took me a long time to realize I was a successful content creator and not somebody struggling to get listens. And I don't know why that took so long, but it did. It took a while for me to realize people listened to what we said and it was impactful. And talking about the previous question about like dealing with the downside and snapping at people or something, it took me a long time to realize that was impactful too. I wasn't just like some random person snapping back at another random person. I was a content creator who the person listened to and maybe respected who was then snapping back at them. And I try not to do it, but like it took me a long time to realize that that power dynamic had shifted. I was somebody who was well known. I wasn't just some rando saying something to another random person.
For me, I don't know. I mean, this kind of ends up being a little cheesy, but like I've met a lot of other queer players who just wanted to say thank you for me being out on the show and that it meant a lot to them. And I think for me, I was just trying to be like, I'll just live my life. It's not a big deal. But hearing from so many of them, clearly it is a big deal. I'm just like, oh, that's neat. Like that's really cool.
Yeah.
But a specific moment that sticks out to me was a gentleman who I met at a magic event who told me that his kid is queer and that he just wants to be a good dad. He just wants to support his child, but he doesn't know how to connect sometimes. And he doesn't know what he doesn't know. He doesn't know that experience. And he just wants to have a good relationship with his kid. But since he and his kid play EDH, me being out on the show and that being a thing that they both listened to, that like kind of reinforced a cool bond between the two of them and that it was a really big deal to both of them. And that just blew my mind. Like that was a really cool moment that I'm trying not to sound emotional about, but it is like really freaking cool. And I'm like, yeah, dang, man. So like that really sticks with me. That was a moment where it was just like, oh, impact. And so I'm trying to be silly about it to avoid like looking at it directly because it's like looking at the sun. But like, yeah, that was a really, really cool thing to hear. So hope you and your kid are doing well, man. It was a great time to meet you.
Yeah, I remember there was a moment when we were in Vegas and we were kind of chatting. It was after our meet and greet and a listener came up who I won't name them. But shortly after we did their patron shout out, because they were our patron shout out of the week, we did our usual botchery of their name and they came up and said one of their parents had passed away shortly before the episode aired. And so right after it aired, that was one of the first things that happened. And so just having that moment of release, that was really humbling. And as somebody who also has lost a parent at a young age, those moments are hard. And so being able to kind of give some relief to two listeners in those heavy moments. We have fun here. We try to be silly and entertaining, but being able to have real impacts on moments like that, that felt very, I hate saying very good because it's a heavy moment, but being able to help folks through those types of moments, that was very humbling for sure. So Shaky Mortal, I hope you wanted heavy answers because that's what you're going to get when we're feeling retrospective about these 300 episodes here.
No, well, what a lovely note to end on too, though. Like, what a cool. Especially like I feel like we moved to video. A lot of our popularity kind of surged during lockdown. So like another moment that kind of stands out was when like the world finally eased back open and we could all go to events again. We could go to a Magic Fest, a Command Fest, a Magic Con or whatever. And like we could meet with people who were just like, hey, it's you guys. And it was like that was a completely a gear shift from the way that I previously engaged with Magic Cons. And so that too is just like, wah! So like, yeah, there have been those moments that are just like, oh, wow, I didn't realize how cool and impactful and meaningful those things would be. So to meet listeners in the first place, to have those types of moments is so rad. So, yeah.
Well, the other one I'll briefly throw out is that there, and I think we've all had this too in the last year or so, when a random person on the street or somewhere where you are recognizes you for what you do, that to me was also a moment where like it was a bartender in a bar and also I think a teller at a bank in a drive-thru. My bank drive-thru was like, wait a minute, you're Dana from the Indian Track. Are Matt and Joey here somewhere?
No. we live in different states, man. Sorry. Yeah.
But like that was a weird thing too. Like I never thought that would happen.
I mean, I'll say I got recognized twice at the Seattle Art Museum while I was on a date. And that felt really cool. Honestly, I was just like, you know what? Maybe I'm doing something, right? Like that was kind of neat. I think that's like, yeah, that That was fun. I'm going to feel my zhuzh in that moment, but for the most part, I don't want to sound too full of it because, I mean, genuinely, I've gone to Magic Cons where we super don't, like, it's just like, I don't know, we're just nerdy dudes walking around. Like, end of the day, that is still ultimately where we're at.
We still ultimately are very much there, yes.
We put our deck box together top and bottom just like you.
We double sleeve our cards one sleeve after the other.
We struggle to do it.
Listen, Matt, not all of us do double sleeve our decks, actually.
Yeah, the monsters do.
Monsters? You're calling me a monster?
The gruel players who are lighting Dana's card or books on fire.
Banging two rocks together trying to get the sleeve on.
It's just Boulder Fall is not just like their favorite card.
That's also how they use the ultimate gold boulders as well. Is like, yeah, oh my god.
Oh goodness.
I think we've gone off the deep end.
I believe so.
This was so absolutely splendid. Thank you to all of our patrons for submitting questions. Thank you for our friends for submitting questions. This was just really awesome to be able to take a look back, kick back, answer some cool questions. And I'm here's to another 300 episodes, you know?
Another like 300, yeah. This was fun, but let's do another 300. Why not?
Exactly. And there are plenty of questions that we didn't have time to get to, but thank you all for supporting us through all of these magnificent episodes. And fellas, if our listeners have any questions for you that we didn't get to on the show, where can they find you to pick your brain? Matt?
Well, you can find me on pretty much any social media platform at Mathimus55. That's MathimuS55. And if you'd like to send us a question, maybe we'll do another mailbag here. Send us an email at edhrecast@gmail.com as well.
And Dana.
And you can find me online at Dana Roach. I'm writing articles for EDH Rec and Commander's Herald. And you can find all of us together at patreon.com/EDHRecCast.
And I'm Joey Schultz. You can find me at Joseph M. Schultz online, most likely being a fool on Instagram. And of course, you can find the cast at EDH RecCast everywhere online. And we've got to shout out once again at Chase for their fantastic work in the post-production of the show. You can find them online at Mana Curves. Listeners, we'll be back at you next week with more data and insights. But until then, remember, EDH Rec your deck before you wreck your deck.